Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and thank you for joining me on another episode of The Weekly Docket, where every Friday we recap the top stories in the true crime space. So without further ado, we've got a lot to cover, six stories in total, so let's get into it. Imagine this. You're out enjoying a beautiful day with your family, hiking through a scenic park, when out of nowhere, some creepy guy lurking in the shadows comes out and attacks your parents right in front of you. Now, that is exactly what happened to the Brink family at Devil's Den State Park in Arkansas this week. On a seemingly perfect Sunday afternoon, Clinton David Brink and his wife, Kristen Amanda Brink, took their two young daughters, ages 7 and 9, out to the park to spend some quality family time together. It was supposed to be a day filled with fresh air and sunshine and memories, and yet it turned into this unimaginable tragedy. On July 23rd, around 3 p.m., police received frantic calls about an attack on a hiking trail inside the popular state park. When they arrived, they discovered the Brinks, 43-year-old Clinton and 41-year-old Kristen, had been brutally stabbed to death. But what's even more sick about this story is that their young daughters witnessed the entire thing. The entire thing. Somehow the girls managed to escape physically unharmed, but emotionally, it's hard to imagine the trauma that they're going to face for the rest of their lives. Now, as news of the attack spread, people were wondering how something like this happens in Devil's Den State Park, because it's normally known as a family-friendly place where people regularly bring their kids for just outdoor adventure. So who would do this? Within days, investigators had an answer. Authorities had actually released a photo that was of this guy's backside, and they were asking the public for help. And after they were combing through witness statements, evidence, and surveillance footage from the park's entrance, they finally narrowed it down to 28-year-old James Andrew McGann, a man who up until that day had no connection to the Brink family. But here's where it gets even more chilling. James Andrew McGann was not just some random drifter. He was an elementary school teacher. He had recently moved to Arkansas after accepting a position teaching third grade at Bayari Elementary School in Springdale. But this was not his first teaching job. He previously taught at multiple schools across Oklahoma and Texas, including the Broken Arrow School District, Northwoods Fine Arts Academy, and Flower Mound Elementary. At different schools, he had gone by different names, using sometimes Andrew at some or Drew at the others. And who knows if that's an attempt to distance himself from his past. But speaking of his past, parents of former students have now come forward with some really disturbing allegations. Several parents claimed that their children had told them that James had behaved inappropriately towards young girls in his classes. At one point, these parents say that they reported their concerns to the school principals, but instead of facing consequences or an investigation, James was quietly allowed to resign without any formal discipline, leaving him free to move from school district to school district without a mark on his professional record. And with all of the teacher stories that are coming out lately with Christina Formella, and there's been so many other instances of these female teachers having inappropriate relationships with their young male students. But here's one, of course, of a man who's doing this with young children. But in almost every story, it's like, yeah, they had been accused of something like this in the past, but they were just forced to resign. And it seems like that is how they are allowed to get away with this. So I don't know what this means going forward, if there needs to be some sort of stricter laws within their school districts, or I don't know. It just seems like this is happening at an alarming rate. And that it always gets to this point before something is done. Like, why can't we take care of this before something crazy happens? But anyway, McGann was taken into custody at a barber shop in Springdale. He was literally right in the middle of getting a haircut, and he was completely unbothered, going about his day as if nothing had happened. Now, investigators are still piecing together his motive for the deadly attack on the Brink family. We're wondering, was this a premeditated attack? Was it random? Or did McGann have some twisted intention related to the children? Because like I said, the daughters were only 7 and 9 years old, which that's like second to third grade. And that's the kind of grade that he taught in the past. So The fact that the Brink daughters weren't physically harmed but forced to witness the brutal attack has many people wondering if the parents were trying to protect their children from something that he intended to do to them. He's currently charged with 2 counts of capital murder, and he is being held without bond while he awaits his first appearance in court. Meanwhile, the community has really rallied around the Brink family, holding vigils, organizing fundraisers, doing whatever they can to support the 2 little girls who lost their parents in such a horrific way. I'll put pictures of this guy up on our Instagram at mama.mysterypodcast, but he does have a very eerie look to him, very similar to Brian Koberger, where there is just no soul behind those eyes. You look at the eyes and it's like, they're just black. And it, some people, you just see it, and I don't really know how to describe it other than to just say that there is nothing behind those eyes. Since he is charged with capital murder in Arkansas typically involves premeditated murder or murder committed during another felony, which in this case, he committed 2 felonies at the same time. So that is why it is eligible for capital murder, which is eligible for the death penalty. So I'll keep an eye on this case and let you know as updates come out. Next, I want to talk to you about a heartbreaking story out of Tennessee that has been all over the news lately. I'm not sure many people realize just how deep this tragedy really runs, though, because it's like once you peel out a layer, you peel back even more and more, and it's just like, oh my gosh, this story just keeps getting worse. Now, it started early in the morning of July 29th when a resident in a rural part of Dyer County stepped outside their home and discovered something pretty shocking. An abandoned baby strapped into a car seat left alone in their front yard. Now, this baby girl was just 7 months old. Thankfully, she was unharmed, but no one had any idea who she belonged to or how she ended up there. The discovery quickly launched a desperate effort to find the child's parents. Authorities began piecing together clues, and by that afternoon, about 20 miles away in neighboring Lake County, they made an absolutely devastating discovery. 4 bodies were discovered on the side of a quiet rural road. The victims were identified as 20-year-old Adriana Williams and her fiance, 21-year-old James Matthew Wilson. And these two were this baby girl's parents. Also found with the parents were Adriana's mother, 38-year-old Courtney Rose, and Adriana's 15-year-old brother, Braden Williams. All 4 had been shot to death. Now, immediately, law enforcement connected the abandoned infant to these murders. 2 vehicles belonging to the family were found abandoned near the scene, suggesting that whoever committed these horrific crimes either brought or lured them there deliberately. Now, as details of the murders emerged, authorities launched an intense investigation involving the TBI, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, and the FBI. But here's something I think hasn't gotten enough attention yet. While this tragedy has been widely covered, there are 2 other children involved who are also suffering, largely unnoticed by the media. Now, Courtney Rose was not just the mother of Adriana and Braden. She had 2 younger children who have now essentially lost their entire family. So just think about that. In one day, these 2 young kids lost their mother, their older brother, and for all practical purposes, their brother-in-law as well. And then to make things even more devastating, their father is currently incarcerated. Although he's technically only the biological father of 1 of the children, he was actively involved in both of their lives before he went to jail. Now, Adriana and Braden's biological father is also behind bars. So now these 2 kids are facing this unimaginable loss, essentially orphaned and left behind by this unspeakable crime. Investigators have not yet publicly identified any suspects or motives, which is really leaving a lot of people in the community on edge, wondering who could do something like this and why. It's just one of those cases that really leaves you with more questions than answers. Even as you find more answers, you just somehow find more questions. So was this personal? Was this targeted? Was it completely random? And how exactly did that 7-month-old baby end up alone miles away from where her family was found? Now, authorities are pleading for information from the public. They're hoping that someone somewhere saw something or knows something that could lead to justice. But until then, there are now 3 young lives dramatically changed, 2 children who have lost almost everything, and then an innocent baby whose first year of life has already been marked by this unthinkable tragedy. And who knows where she's going to end up. It just makes me sick to my stomach. So I actually will keep a close eye on this one. And if I end up having to do a deep dive on it at some point, then I will. I'm inclined to think that this isn't completely random. However, leaving the baby on the side of the road does make it seem like it could be more random, and that for some reason the captors or the assailants in this story just couldn't bring themselves to shoot a baby, but they could a 15-year-old. I mean, none of it makes sense. I can't make sense of any of it, obviously, but I will try to keep an eye on it and let you know as updates come out. This next story comes out of Moberly, Missouri, and it's one of those cases that is confusing and deeply frustrating, especially because the details are just not adding up. On July 6th, around 7:30 in the evening, police received a call from 68-year-old David Kip Hyde. He told dispatchers that he had just shot a woman on his front porch, claiming that she had become aggressive and that he acted in self-defense. But when officers arrived at the scene in the 900 block of East Logan Street, they found 23-year-old Bailey Scott dead from a single gunshot wound to her torso. Now, at first glance, you might wonder what led to this tragic confrontation. Well, according to Hyde, he noticed Bailey walking down the street in front of his house looking suspicious. He claimed he didn't know her, despite the fact that Bailey had lived right across the street for about a year and a half. So keep that detail in mind because it's important. Now, Hyde says that Bailey initially stepped onto his porch, but left before he could even answer the door. So when she returned a second time, he decided to confront her, hiding a .32-caliber handgun behind his back. Hyde alleged that Bailey became agitated, upset about him feeding and killing birds in his yard, which is an odd detail, but apparently that's what he said. Now, according to Hyde, Bailey then slapped him across the face, prompting him to fire his gun at her twice. But here's the thing, and it's a big thing. Investigators immediately noticed that Hyde's story did not match the physical evidence at all. There were no visible injuries on Hyde's face, despite his claims of being slapped, and Bailey's hands showed no signs of having struck anyone. So in other words, like, the self-defense story just did not add up. And let's circle back to Hyde's claim that he didn't recognize Bailey. Neighbors and coworkers quickly called foul on that. Bailey's coworker, Lindsay Smith, publicly called Hyde a liar, saying that there's no way Bailey would have provoked a confrontation. Now, another coworker of hers, Rayvon Davis, pointed out something pretty obvious, which was that Hyde had lived at that residence since 1996 and Bailey for a year and a half, so they had undoubtedly crossed paths before. It's also important to understand who Bailey was, a young single mother described by friends as sweet, kind, and non-confrontational. She leaves behind a 3-year-old son, and everyone who knew her insists that she was the last person who would just randomly pick a fight with someone, especially over something as trivial as birds in somebody's yard. Meanwhile, Hyde is also not just some random homeowner. He's a former police officer and city employee, someone that you would expect to handle conflict responsibly, but instead, this retired cop escalated the situation to deadly violence. He was charged with second-degree murder after authorities concluded his account was inconsistent with forensic evidence and eyewitness statements. So he is currently in jail awaiting trial, and it sounds to me like this might be a case of just an old man on a power trip who maybe thought that his connections to law enforcement would, you know, give him a free pass to behave poorly, and that his sorry excuse would carry more weight because of his past as a cop. Now, this is just me obviously assuming. I don't know. But as more details come out, if I need to update you all, I will. Now, this next story is one that I've been wanting to cover for a while because so many of you have recommended this case to me, and it bears some similarities to the last story I just told you. Now, this next one is out of Arkansas. It's a wild case, and court files have finally come to light to fill in some of the blanks on what really happened that night. So I want to update you guys with the most accurate information that I can from what I found. Now, it's just past 1 a.m. on October 8th of 2024. Aaron Spencer, a 36-year-old Army veteran from Lonoke County, is jolted awake by his dog barking. He checks on his daughter and realizes that his 13-year-old daughter was missing from her room. So alarmed, he immediately called 911, reporting her missing, and he is afraid that she may have been taken by Michael Fossler, a 67-year-old man who was previously arrested in July on 43 charges, including sexual assault of a minor and internet stalking of Aaron Spencer's daughter when she was just 13 years old. Now, records later revealed that a no-contact order was in place, but Aaron tells investigators that Michael had violated it and potentially abducted his daughter. So he calls Cabot police to check a specific address, and while waiting, he spots Michael's white Ford F-150 on the road, and he sees his daughter in Michael's truck. So at that point, they're both in their trucks. Aaron is honking, flashing his lights, trying to get Michael to pull over. And then at Highway 236 and 13 North, he finally rams Michael's truck from behind, sending it into a ditch. At that point, Aaron gets out, he draws his weapon, and he's ordering Michael to get out of the vehicle and lay down in the ditch. His daughter is like inside the truck trying to escape, while Michael is allegedly trying to keep her inside the truck. So Aaron states that Michael lunged toward him and said, "Fuck you," prompting Aaron to then open fire with a Glock 19 Gen 4 pistol. So he fired multiple shots, hitting Michael in the chest, arms, and abdomen. And Michael reportedly resisted even after being shot, prompting Aaron to jump on him and pistol whip him at that point, which is corroborated by the affidavit because apparently there was blood on the outside of the gun when it was recovered. After that, Aaron retrieved his daughter, returned to his truck, reloaded, and made a second 911 call, notifying authorities saying, quote, "He's dead on the side of the road. I had no choice," end quote. Aaron bonded out the next afternoon and was initially arrested on a first-degree murder charge, but the Lonoke County prosecutor later downgraded his charges to second-degree murder and a felony weapons charge on November 27th. Aaron's legal team at that point issued a pretty powerful statement. His lawyers, Aaron Casanelli and Michael Kaiser, pointed out that Aaron was a decorated war hero who protected his country and he was a loving father. They characterized Michael as someone who repeatedly violated Aaron's child and kidnapped her in that night in order to continue his assaults on his daughter. Any parent, especially the parent of a daughter, can probably empathize with Aaron in this story. But one controversial chapter was that a gag order was imposed by Circuit Judge Barbara Elmore to prevent Aaron's side from speaking publicly. And the order extended to sealing the entire case file, even though prosecutors had not requested it. So Aaron's attorneys filed a 19-page response to dismiss the gag order. In March, Aaron appealed, and on May 29th, the Arkansas Supreme Court struck down the gag order, deeming it an unconstitutional violation of First Amendment rights and chastised the lower court's overreach. So the high court remanded the case for future proceedings and removed Judge Elmore from the case to ensure that the case is handled fairly going forward. So that's a relief to see, because often we see, like in the case of Karen Reed, for example, Judge Bev, it seemed like she was so biased the entire time. And the fact that she was able to rule on the first trial and then again on the second, like, and I know a lot of people were kind of up in arms because it seemed like she was really biased. I think she was pretty biased as well. But at least in this case, we see that the judge has been removed and there will be a different one presiding. So as of right now, Aaron is free on bond, awaiting a pretrial hearing on August 8th, and a 5-day trial is scheduled to begin on September 22nd. I am going to keep an eye on this case because I've also heard people, and I haven't found that this was actually corroborated. So I'm just kind of saying this as like something that I'm hearing going around, but I don't know how much truth is to it. So maybe I shouldn't even be saying it, but you guys are my friends. So apparently when Aaron was placed in the back of the police car, there was drug paraphernalia in the back of the police car. And what I've heard through various sources is that Michael Fossler had a connection to the police department. And so some people felt like Aaron was being framed for a drug charge and was, you know, not being treated fairly because of Michael's connections to the police department. How true that is, I don't know. I'm sure when the trial starts, we'll learn more. I do plan on watching it because I think this case is very interesting. And as the mother of daughters and sons, I can't say I would, you know, do anything differently than Aaron did. And honestly, it sounds like Michael was able to abuse the daughter once before and get reprimanded, but apparently that wasn't enough. And so, yeah, I think Aaron is completely justified. I'll see what ends up happening though, and I'll let you guys know. So on to the next one. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out for more new to you styles. I will admit I was a little skeptical at first because I'm not the type of person who dresses up very often, but you guys, this is actually so perfect and I'm genuinely so excited about this new membership with Armoire. And I want to tell you what the process was like for me. I got onto their website and I mean, there were so much to choose from. I ended up choosing 6 items and I was kind of like, we'll see what happens, you know, not sure how they were going to arrive, if they were going to be like noticeably used or what. But listen, 2 days after I placed my like case order, it showed up on my doorstep. Everything was like, when I pulled it out of the bag, everything was neatly folded and then tied up in this really pretty little bow. And I got so excited. I'm actually taking a trip to Dallas with my daughter soon, so I'm gonna wear an outfit for that. Austin and I are gonna go to a Teddy Swims concert, so I got an outfit for that. I'm like, you guys, I'm so excited about this because everything showed up in great condition. I mean, I think it looks brand new. And it's $900 worth of clothes that I'm renting for less than $100. And the best part for me is that I can just send it back. I don't typically dress up that often, but this is so perfect for like the random occasions that I do dress up without having to go and like splurge on an entire new outfit that I might only wear once. I will be honest, I feel guilty that over half of my closet has only been worn once, if at all. And there are even a few items that are going to Goodwill with the tags on them. So I love being on trend and having new things to wear, but I hate the waste that I'm creating when I do that, right? So Armoire allows me to rent these high quality designer clothes for any occasion and then just send it back. If you've got a wedding or a job interview or just like anything that you just want to kind of dress up a little bit. But the nice thing is they also have athleisure. So I got this really cute Kate Spade anorak jacket that I can wear with like a pair of leggings, and it just kind of makes you feel a little more dressed up while you're still dressed down. I also got some really cool floral wide leg pants from Steve Madden with this really cute denim halter like front vest top to go with it. And just in case that doesn't work out, I got another option too to go with the pants, and then I can have like kind of 2 outfits in one. You guys, I cannot tell you enough how excited I am about this. And right now my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Please try Armoire today. And if you do, tag me in the pictures of your outfits so I can get some inspiration and kind of see what y'all are getting. But this is so fun. I'm really, really excited about this. Thanks again to Armoire for sponsoring today's episode. And now back to the story. This one is coming out of Utah, and it's about a woman named Catherine Rastelli. She's 37 years old, who recently admitted in court that she planned the murder of her estranged husband, Matthew Rastelli, alongside her own mother and brother. And honestly, the details in this one are pretty wild. Catherine and Matthew Rastelli were locked in a messy custody battle over their 2 kids. They're originally from California. Catherine abruptly moved with the children to Utah without Matthew's consent, making the custody fight even more contentious. So Matthew, desperate to reunite with his children and possibly even reconcile with Catherine, became pretty desperate and vulnerable to her manipulations. So in early July of 2024, Catherine started kind of laying the groundwork. And according to court documents, she reached out to Matthew, convincing him that she had had a change of heart. She expressed interest in reconciling their relationship and invited him to come to Utah to see her and the kids. Matthew, understandably eager and hopeful about fixing his family, you know, quickly agreed, and he had no idea what was actually waiting for him. In the days leading up to Matthew's visit, Catherine meticulously tracked his movements. She secretly placed a GPS device on his vehicle and regularly communicated with him to monitor exactly when he would arrive. She also told Matthew to simply enter the house upon arrival, making it clear that he was welcome and expected. On July 12th, Matthew arrived at Catherine's mother's home in American Fork, Utah, believing that he was there for this joyful reunion. But the reality, sadly, was the complete opposite. Court records reveal that as Matthew entered the home, Catherine's brother, 29-year-old Kevin Ellis, was waiting with a gun. Within moments of stepping inside, Matthew was ambushed and shot multiple times. Catherine remained upstairs throughout the attack, fully aware of the violence that was going on downstairs, and she later admitted to hearing the shots and knowing exactly what was happening downstairs. Immediately following Matthew's death, the family quickly set the stage to make the killing look like it was self-defense. Catherine, her brother, Kevin, and their mother, 59-year-old Tracy Marie Grist, collaborated to carefully stage this crime scene. They strategically placed a knife in Matthew's hand to portray him as an aggressor, and they rearranged furniture and even removed a screen door beforehand to make their staged scenario more believable. Tracy then called 911, claiming that Matthew had violently barged into their home and that they had no choice but to defend themselves. But their story quickly began to unravel. Before the family's call was placed, a neighbor had already called police after hearing gunshots. Authorities arrived almost immediately and noticed inconsistencies right away. The knife being awkwardly placed in Matthew's hand just did not appear natural, and investigators found the arrangement suspicious and staged, sparking a deeper investigation into the family's claims. Facing mounting evidence against her, Catherine then eventually confessed to her role in orchestrating the murder. And this summer, in July of 2025, she entered a guilty plea, officially admitting to conspiring to kill her estranged husband. Catherine pleaded guilty specifically to charges of murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and felony discharge of a firearm as part of a plea deal that requires her cooperation against her mother and brother. In her confession, Catherine openly admitted that from the start, their plan was always to kill Matthew. She confirmed that she knowingly and intentionally deceived him, using his desire to reconcile their family against him. Even more disturbing, Catherine confirmed that her own children were present in the house upstairs at the time that their own father was killed, which initially resulted in additional child endangerment charges, but these charges were later dismissed as part of Catherine's plea agreement. Now, Catherine is scheduled to be sentenced in September, facing anywhere from 6 years up to life in prison, depending on how the judge rules. Her mother, Tracy, and brother, Kevin, have both pleaded not guilty to their charges, which include murder, conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and additional weapons charges for Kevin. Their trials are set for January of 2026, and with Catherine now cooperating against them, their chances are not looking good. And I feel like we've seen a lot of cases like this lately. It kind of has like similarities to Lori Daybell and the Adelson family. I can't think of her first name. It was Dan Markell. We covered this story in, I believe, episode 170. It was like right after we got back from having baby Ellie. But anyway, it's just kind of crazy how we see these custody battles resort to murder. And it just being such a foiled plot. Like, I can't believe people are this stupid. But anyway, on to the next one. This is actually our last story of the docket, but this is one that recently wrapped up this week. And I've covered this story before, but I can't remember when I talked about it. So let me just give you a quick background. We're coming out of Aurora, Colorado, and it's been making headlines for months now, but we finally have a conclusion. James Craig was a local dentist who was found guilty of murdering his wife, Angela Craig, by poisoning her protein shakes. And the details were chilling. Angela Craig, a mom of six kids, first got seriously ill in March of 2023. She started experiencing dizziness, severe headaches, and nausea. And at first, Angela and her doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong. Her symptoms progressively got worse, and she ended up hospitalized multiple times over just a few weeks. Each time, though, the doctors struggled to find an explanation. And then finally, the last time she went to the hospital, her condition deteriorated rapidly and she died shortly after her symptoms even began. So at first glance, James Craig seemed like this grieving husband. He accompanied Angela to her doctor's appointments. He showed concern over this mystery illness and appeared devastated by her sudden death. But something was not sitting right with investigators, and Angela's rapid decline, of course, raised suspicions. So authorities started digging, and what they found was shocking. According to her toxicology results, she had lethal levels of potassium cyanide poison in her system. Immediately, the investigation turned towards James Craig, and as they traced his steps, they found some clues. Court records revealed that James Craig had meticulously planned his wife's poisoning for weeks. Investigators found online searches that he made about potassium cyanide, its effects, and ways to purchase it discreetly. And he was actually doing this on the computer at his dental office. Not only that, but he ordered it to have it delivered at the dental office. And on March 9th, James texted his dental assistant saying that he was expecting a priority package at the office. And he seemed unusually anxious about this package's arrival, repeatedly reminding staff to keep an eye out for it and to keep the office accessible even after business hours. Well, this caught the attention of the office manager, Caitlin Romero, and when the package finally arrived on March 13th, it was her that received it. And here's an important distinction. She didn't actually open the box or handle the contents within the box, but it was the invoice and the shipping labels that immediately raised red flags, because clearly marked on the outside documentation was that chemical potassium cyanide. Like it's in bold letters because they don't want you to open it unless you know that that's in there. So of course she recognized the seriousness of what she was reading, and right away she Googled potassium cyanide, seeing the dangerous nature of the substance. She became alarmed with that. So she quickly reported it internally, and then that suspicion eventually became key evidence in the case. So, of course, all of that paired with the fact that he was searching things on the internet like undetectable poisons and symptoms of cyanide poisoning and even how to make murder look like a heart attack. This guy actually Googled that. Let that sink in. This guy is an actual doctor. So that paired with the toxicology reports confirming that she had been poisoned with a lethal cocktail of substances, not only cyanide, but arsenic, and even, and I'm probably going to butcher this, but even tetrahydrozoline, a chemical found in eye drops. Now, investigators determined James had poisoned Angela repeatedly through her protein shakes and possibly pills that he provided, all under the guise of helping her improve her health. And his motive was shockingly pretty simple. Financial troubles and a series of extramarital affairs, one with an orthodontist out of Texas. And investigators uncovered severe financial stress at his dental practice. There was debt from failed business ventures. And then, of course, multiple relationships that he was having outside of his marriage. And then, of course, rather than face the personal and financial consequences of a divorce, because I'm pretty sure he was Mormon, and I believe that the Mormon faith has pretty strict rules on divorce, rather than do that, he decided that murder was better. I'll never, ever, ever understand that reconciliation. But during the trial, prosecutors laid out a meticulous case detailing how James planned, purchased, and administered these poisons. They introduced evidence of his incriminating search histories, the package that he received at the office, and then video surveillance showing him at suspicious hours in his dental practice. Staff members, including his office manager that I mentioned earlier and one of his receptionists, testified about James's odd behavior leading up to Angela's hospitalization, especially his anxiety about the package containing the cyanide. The defense tried to argue that Angela might have intentionally taken the poison herself, citing past journal entries where she mentioned that she was very depressed and that she was having marital stress, and at times she might have said things that appeared suicidal. But that theory quickly fell apart under some scrutiny, as prosecutors pointed out James's elaborate efforts to cover his tracks, including trying to manipulate evidence and witnesses after his arrest. I know I talked about, I gotta find the episode on this, but I remember him sending this really long text to his ex-business partner regarding this whole thing. I mean, this guy was just so unhinged. And the message was something about how he didn't want his business partner to reveal the truth about James's affair, I think. Man, like talking about this case and this all coming up makes me want to do another deep dive on it. And I might have to, just because now my brain is like, I feel like I held in a sneeze because I don't have all the facts. But in July, so this month, after deliberations, the jury, of course, found James Craig guilty of first-degree murder. He was also convicted of several additional charges, including solicitation to tamper with evidence, perjury, and even solicitation to commit murder when he reportedly asked a fellow inmate to harm a detective involved in this case. I'm going to have to do a deep dive. I think I'm going to do it Tuesday. So I can't live like this, you guys. I have to have more answers. With that is all I have for this week. A spoiler alert, I guess, whenever you guys do listen to the deep dive on James Craig, because you kind of already know how it ends, but the details of the story are just insane. And I remember thinking, this guy is a doctor. Like, he should be smart. You should be smarter than this. But yeah, just never underestimate the fact that you cannot teach common sense, and they don't give degrees for common sense, apparently. So I'll see you guys on Tuesday with a deep dive, likely on James Craig. And I hope you all have a great weekend. Stay safe, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.